This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the president of VREF about aircraft valuation. In the news, we look at a replacement for the Fat Albert C-130, an electric airplane being developed by Solar Impulse 2 pilot Andre Borschberg, EASA concerns with the 737 MAX, additive manufacturing in aerospace, and a supersonic flight challenge that is not about the boom. We also have interviews with a Boeing TX experimental test pilot and a major general with the Japanese Ministry of Defense. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 560 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast, the 2008 CFI of the Year, and an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max, how are you?
I am awesome. Great to be back here with you and the rest of the gang.
Terrific. Also joining us is our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
Hey, good morning to you, to the Maxes and all the voices in the air that can hear my voice.
All right. David Vanderhoof is off again. I think we'll give you a little update on David coming up in a little bit. But first, let's introduce our guest this episode. That's Jason Zilberbrand. He's president and CTO of VREF Aircraft Value Reference and Appraisal Services. We're just going to call it VREF. He's an aircraft appraiser, an expert witness, broker, inventorying dealer, acquisition agent. Get ready, there's a lot more. Aircraft owner and operator, contract negotiator, consultant, teacher, conference speaker, and an author. Jason spent over 15 years as an inventory aircraft dealer with a $300 million credit facility and over $4.5 billion in aircraft transactions. After spending 25 years in general aviation, working directly with aircraft owners, operators, and owning and operating his own aircraft, Jason knows the international aviation marketplace pretty well. He's considered an expert in aircraft valuations and aircraft transactions, and his background is diverse with a knowledge in technology and aviation. Jason, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max.
Now, VREF delivers aircraft and engine data through online subscription services and also quarterly digests. VREF provides valuations, appraisals, and litigation consulting services to a worldwide client base of aviation professionals. They include law firms, banks, financial institutions, leasing companies, manufacturers, as well as aircraft owners and operators and suppliers. So that's a lot of activity, Jason. I think you're pretty solidly immersed in what's going on aviation-wise these days.
Yeah, thanks. It is a lot of work. We have a pretty big staff to help, you know, assist with all of it. But VREF, as a lot of people know, is the publisher of a quarterly digest and an online subscription software database where people can go in and create their own values based on their equipment list for the aircraft that they're either trying to buy or trying to sell. When we took over management of the company, we added in our appraisal work and expert witness work, which we'll go into in a bit, I guess.
Yes, very good. All right. Well, we're going to dive into that coming up. First, we're going to take a look at some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready deep in the heart of.
Our first item comes from avgeekery.com. This is Blue Angels to receive upgraded Fat Albert from the UK. Now, I'm sure most of you know or are aware that the Blue Angels have a support aircraft. It's called Fat Albert. It's a C-130T, and it's scheduled to be replaced in 2020. And Launchpad, this replacement aircraft looks like it's coming from an interesting place.
Oh, it is. And we're going to circle around to that answer. For all our listeners who are big Blue Angel fans, the Blue Angels have been flying C-130s as Fat Albert since the 70s. The first one was a KC-130F, which was introduced in 1970. The current airframe is a C-130 Tango, as Max just said, and has been with the team since 2002. And it has the distinction of being the last C-130 to conduct a jet-assisted or JATO takeoff. In fact, our own David Vanderhoof has ridden on this aircraft for a media flight. But the Navy needs something new. This one's kind of old, and what they're going to do is they're buying a British C-130J. The Navy Air Systems Command says this is going to save nearly $50 million over buying a new C-130J. The price tag for a used C-130J is $29.7 million. Something tells me they found that value on VREF.
I'm taking notes.
Yeah.
This is a win-win for the Navy and the United Kingdom, says program manager from the United States Navy Air Systems Command. The British Navy needed, or the British Ministry of Defense needed to divest itself of some 130Js that were low time, and the Navy needed a 130J. So they'll take delivery in April 2020. In the meantime, the Fat Albert will be out of the show thing. But my question is, since it has British roots, are we now going to call it Uncle Albert?
It would kind of make a certain amount of sense, wouldn't it? But Fat Albert is going, well, it's going to live on. They're not scrapping it, apparently. It's going to be used for ground-based training in Fort Worth, Texas, Launchpad.
Yeah, my half of the woods.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I think you're right that this is kind of a good deal for everybody when you've got, you know, a party looking to buy and a party looking to sell, and they've come together. Jason, you don't do military aircraft at VREF, do you?
We do a couple warbirds.
Oh.
Yeah, so if subscribers or anybody for that matter request an aircraft to be placed into the database, we do our best to do so. Military stuff can be complicated, as you guys know.
Valuation must be tough. I mean, it kind of, I guess, would depend on what the buyer's looking to do and what the seller's looking to do. I mean, that's true in all cases, I guess, but I would assume that the volume of warbirds trading would be pretty low. So that would be
very low.
Yeah.
There are some helicopter conversions that we see becoming more popular. So I guess from that standpoint, you know, conversions will do. But we do have a senior appraiser that specializes in military, and that's Ken DeFore. So he does take on a lot of that one-off type of stuff.
Okay. Next item. This Max Trescott found this from Wired.com. An aviation pioneer goes all in on electric planes. And Max, this is kind of a follow-up to a previous guest on this podcast.
It is, and it's always kind of fun when you see somebody who does something that's significant, and then you kind of wonder, well, what's next? And that's kind of what we have in this story here. This all goes back to 3 years ago when André Borschberg and Bertrand, I misspoke it there, Bertrand Picard flew around the world in the Solar Impulse 2. Now, they didn't do it nonstop. It took them a number of months to do it. But the aircraft was solar-powered, wings the length of a 747, and basically it was flown solo. So not really a practical aircraft, but a great demonstration of you know, what electricity can do in aircraft. So cycle forward 3 years, and André Borschberg has now started a new company in the electric aircraft business. The company's called H55. Doesn't say why it's called H55.
Yeah, I was kind of curious about that, yeah.
You know, I've met him, and I'm thinking maybe that's his age. But anyway, so Borschberg has the first airplane that is going to stay aloft for 90 minutes, carries two people, and it's a modified version of an aircraft that's currently made by the Czech Republic's BRM Aero. And this electric version is going to be called the Bristol Energic, kind of an interesting name. Anyway, it's got a 50 kilowatt hour battery, or batteries, if you will. And they say they can be fully charged in about an hour, climbs 900 feet per minute, cruises 125 miles an hour, which they says is about the same performance as the engine-powered version of the airplane. Now, there are literally dozens and dozens of companies that are, you know, producing electric airplanes, or rather have announced that they're going to produce electric airplanes. And I certainly don't cover each and every one of them. But, you know, I'm always struck by when either a significant person or a major company is getting involved. And, you know, this to me is significant.
And you've pointed out, I think, several times, Max, that a trainer is a good application for an electric airplane at this point in time. Because of the, you know, sort of cycles that you would expect from, a training program, and the duration, the capability, the flight time of typical electric airplanes.
Exactly. I've always said we needed a minimum of 1 hour to make it practical. 90 minutes, I think, is really the sweet spot. And it's going to be perfect for just drilling landing, especially if you're staying in your own pattern or in a airport that's relatively close by. Not so great for long cross countries, but already there's some infrastructure starting to be put in place for that. We've got two different groups in California that are starting to install charge stations in different regions. Not very many of them out there, but you know, there will come a time, I think, when people will be able to recharge their airplanes much the way that electric cars go to a Tesla superstation so that they can drive all the way across the country.
As you guys know, as Launchpad, I have a side market where I a relationship with Pipistrel Aircraft, and we are delivering an electric aircraft that is being used for the trainer. It has 1 hour plus legal reserve. And that's an important thing, is that the FAA still says you have to have enough energy left in your batteries for the legal reserve. But it's interesting to me that already we've been delivering the Alpha Electro for, we'll be almost 2 years now, and we're an hour, and already the energy density has gone up to a similar aircraft is now talking about 90 minutes of flight time.
Wow, that's a big jump.
Right, so we were an hour plus legal reserve, and I'm reading between the lines here, he's talking 90 minutes and legal reserve.
Now, is the strategy on the Pipistrel to swap out battery packs or to charge the batteries in the plane?
No, it's charger. The idea being is that you charge an hour, so you take the student up, do the lesson, land, debrief the student, dewater the instructor, rewater the instructor, rebrief the new student, and you're about an hour, and you go back up.
All right. Well, we certainly are seeing a lot of activity in the electric airplane space these days. Taking place with companies all the way from new startups to major airframers. It's sort of hard to deny that this is a trend that is going to continue.
I also think it's interesting that he, like Pipistrel, and I can't think there's another brand coming out of South America, and they're both starting with airframes that already exist and then electrifying them. And the point of their electrification is that the electric one has all the same characteristics as the gas-powered one. It's just slightly quieter.
And you're probably talking about Sling.
I believe so, yes.
All right, well, another week has gone by, so it's about time for another Boeing 737 MAX story. And we do have some developments. Bloomberg says Boeing 737 MAX's autopilot has problem, European regulators find. And this comes from the European Aviation Safety Agency, EASA. And they have five issues with the 737 MAX. Now, these haven't been made public. The sources here are, as far as I can tell, all anonymous. And it's really not known if EASA finds these are hard requirements for return to service or discussion points. Max, have you got these teed up for us?
I do. And the one that really sticks out like a big sore thumb is apparently they found that the autopilot doesn't always properly disengage, which could be a real issue if you're trying to deal with some of the kind of MCAS issues that the airplane had, or any other kind of issue where you just need to disengage the autopilot quickly. they don't really explain in the story what the circumstances are under which it won't disengage and for how long it takes to finally get it disengaged and so on. But those are all important points that, hopefully will get clarified in the future and get resolved. I mean, being able to disconnect an autopilot, in my experience, it takes one button push and it takes half a second, 2 seconds if you struggle to find the right button. Anything longer than that, totally unacceptable. So it's fascinating that they may have, found this kind of problem.
And the other issues are some that have already been reported and discussed. Difficulty turning the manual trim wheel. My favorite, and the one that to me starts to get more towards root cause and some of these other things, which is angle of attack sensor unreliability. Third, inadequate training procedures. And then one that is known, is in the press, but only more recently, and this has to do with a microprocessor software issue. But like you say, Mac, this autopilot failing to disengage in certain situations is something new. I think that, with each one of these things that comes up, the return to service date seems to push out farther and farther. I guess most likely end of the year now, maybe at soonest. But we also see that not only the FAA, but with EASA, Canada, and Brazil have a tentative agreement that the return to service should be, closely coordinated. And I think that makes sense. That was one thing that people were wondering about in the past, is if, each regulatory agency would, at its own pace, grant approval to fly the 737 MAX. I think in this case here, they're getting together and they recognize that from the standpoint of helping rebuild the public trust, I think it's to the advantage of all that there's an agreement on the aircraft entering service kind of worldwide. I mean, I think that's an important thing.
Indeed. And I think there are probably some benefits to having everybody go through the airplane with a fine-tooth comb. They're probably finding things that may be trivial but never would have been found otherwise. So I think ultimately we're going to end up with a really, really safe airplane. I guess the question is, if it gets delayed too long, will people have lost confidence simply because it'll been out of the skies for so long?
Yeah. And these aircraft are stacking up. I mean, we saw, I guess, a week ago that Boeing is, storing them in the parking lot, in the employee parking lot, or one of the lots, in addition to all the other locations around Seattle that they're storing these. And, I mean, they're pumping them out at, I don't know, what's the rate now, 42 or it's 40-something aircraft a month. So each month goes by, that's, a bigger backlog. Makes you wonder what happens or how it's going to be managed once the deliveries of those airplanes can resume. I mean, it's going to be kind of a crush.
My question is just that, with Boeing was maintained at a decelerated rate, but was maintaining production of these, hoping to get these back out by now or, August. Suddenly now we're talking December. Can they keep, at 40 a month, August, September, October, November, December, that's another 200 airframes. Is there parking for 200 airframes, or are they going to have to bite the bullet and stop the line?
Which would be just disastrous for Boeing for several different reasons.
Well, and for customers as well. Aircraft promised to them in subsequent years will now get delayed into further. So I can see why Boeing wants to keep the line running. They've got many years backlog anyway, so you'd like to be able to chew through that backlog as best you can.
Yeah. Jason, can you recall there ever being a situation where other aircraft, due to issues or loss of confidence or something, has had a big impact on valuations? Do we have precedent, or is this kind of the big example of that?
I mean, I think there's always the unfortunate one-off or two-off or three-off in the business jet world that has had, you know, similar situations. Obviously, I mean, this is a massive safety of flight issue, which thank God we've never seen in the business jet side. I mean, fleet-wide groundings. I mean, I think the last one was the Lear 45 back in the 2000s.
Hmm. And what was that due to?
Oh, it was some hinge or a pin in the tail cone. I don't remember. It was a long time ago, but it was fixed. And I mean, it was a 30-45 day grounding, if I remember. But back in those days, there was a serious backlog. I think, you know, it created similar issues with consumer confidence. But yeah, this is scary. I mean, I think, you know, my two cents is, what if it's not December? And what if it's, you know, a year from now, we're still dealing with this? Or what if it never flies again? Uh-huh. And I think there's a lot of people saying that. And how much of this is, you know, unfortunately benefiting Airbus too? So you have end of line cancellations now, which is eroding that backlog.
Well, eventually you start to get into balance of trade, right? Because Boeing is a, you know, huge net exporter for the United States, the largest, as I recall. So all kinds of things, you know, percolate out of this down the road.
Yeah, it's messy.
Now, there's an article in the Washington Post that came out. The headline is, "Long Before the MAX Disasters, Boeing Had a History of Failing to Fix Safety Problems." And along with all the other news stories we talk about, you'll find a link to this story in the show notes. But the Washington Post is reporting that the FAA had been frustrated by the number of safety issues at Boeing. And not only that, but their repeated failure to rectify the situations as they agreed with the FAA. But in 2015, there was a settlement agreement that hasn't really been all that widely reported that bundled all these problems with one, I think, $12 million fine and one kind of overall corrective action plan for systemic issues. But the degree to which Boeing has lived up to this agreement is being questioned in this article. So this doesn't help Boeing either. There are hundreds of comments under the article. And before I got, you know, bored reading through those, most of them are about greedy corporations more concerned about profits than the safety of the public. So even just this report sort of compounds the, you know, the public relations issue that Boeing has. So I don't know. I don't think it could get a whole lot worse.
I think they will bounce back. I really do. Yeah, I mean, I think this is an unfortunate you know, dip along the way, but I think they will recover and continue to, you know, to do a great job.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, a month or two ago, I said that by this time next year, everything will be back to normal. But you know, the start of the normalcy, as Launchpad pointed out, seems to keep pushing out, which is kind of scary. Another technology item, this from Carnegie Mellon. NASA invests in 3D printing for aviation. 3D printing, or additive manufacturing, what they really like to call it, is a big focus area for Carnegie Mellon University. They have a Next Manufacturing Center and Manufacturing Futures Initiative, and that's been selected by NASA to lead a research team looking at new ways to build and power aircraft. A big part of that is additive manufacturing. Carnegie Mellon says over the last 8 years, metals additive manufacturing has had a significant impact on aviation manufacturing for jet engine components, airframe structural elements, and other applications. We believe, they say, this project will continue to substantially advance U.S. manufacturing capabilities in the aerospace and aviation industries. And the partners in this are, it's a pretty impressive list. You've got Argonne National Laboratory, Ansys, Lockheed Martin, Trumpf, Eaton, General Electric, Pratt & Whitney, Northrop Grumman, Metal Powder Works, Siemens Material Solutions, and the Barnes Group. And, of course, when you're making aerospace components using 3D printing or additive manufacturing, this isn't the melt some plastic and off of a spool and build up a little part. These use powdered metals and lasers to heat that, to melt the metal. And you can actually build titanium or titanium alloy parts with this technique. It's pretty impressive.
It is, because if you remember 2 years ago when we were at the Paris Air Show, we did a thing on a guy who was powder printing titanium. It was a heat exchanger that you physically couldn't build any other way. And the point being is the heat exchanger was this really complicated thing, but it was one-third the size if you'd have put regular radiators together to do air cooling. Mm. And it weighed, I think, like a quarter, because it was made out of titanium, of what had been a standard radiator. And it was just amazingly complex, but they printed it in titanium.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
GE Aviation uses electron beam melting machines, and they produce, blades for the GE 9X engine. Rolls-Royce, of course, is 3D printing parts. We'll put a video in the show notes. This will give you an idea of what these things look like and how they work. It's an older video. It's from the manufacturer of this equipment. So it's kind of promotional, but it's a great way to see what these things, like I say, what they look like and really how different they are from the 3D printers you might have sitting in your closet.
Hey, Max, dovetailing with that, while I was at Paris Air Show, we talked to somebody from Marsh who was doing 3D printing down. They're not printing metal, but what they were doing was something that didn't dawn on me that you could do. They were, if you will, doing negative, I don't want to say negative printing, but they were printing the molds for doing the layup.
Yes. Yeah. So that, yeah, printing the negative space. Sure.
Right. Printing the negative space and then sending that into the autoclave to get hardened so that then you could lay up the carbon fiber over it. And what that allowed to do was if suddenly, you know, oh, hey, this whatever, we need a bulge in it, they could redo that bulge and then do the carbon fiber layup.
Yes, yes. One final note on this story. It's noted that process qualification is a real challenge, and this is one of the focus areas that Carnegie Mellon and the partners are going to look at, especially if you're using this technology to produce, you know, one-off parts or, you know, small runs of parts. Process qualification is an important thing, a little bit tricky. So that's something that they're going to focus on. Another thing we've been talking about a lot lately is supersonic flight. And we have this from AeroTime. Supersonic flight meets another challenge besides noise reduction.
Yeah, we've talked a lot over the last few years about supersonic flight and how they're going to reduce their noise footprint. Turns out there's another issue which I hadn't heard about, and that's reducing their heavy carbon footprint. And so there was an agreement, the 75th annual IATA meeting, in which they agreed to reduce the carbon footprint created by aviation, and ultimately they're committed to reducing the emissions from the 2005 level by half by the year 2050, so just 31 years away. And there are a number of folks in the industry who say that's going to make it extremely difficult for some of the new supersonic jets being developed, like Boom's Overture Jet and their other plans that they have to meet these requirements, partially because these engines are going to consume somewhere on the order of 5 to 7 times as much fuel per passenger. So right there, you're already throwing out a heck of a lot more carbon into the atmosphere. Now, Boom has worked with a biofuel company to do a demonstration of using biofuel as one way to reduce the emissions. But there's still folks in the industry who are saying that that might not be enough. Now, coincidentally, I ran across a related story, which I just went back and found here a moment ago. And that also has to do with carbon emissions. In Europe, there are requirements to, you know, pay, well, to not exceed certain levels of carbon. If so, you need to buy, you know, carbon credits. And if you don't, then there are penalties for doing that. And this story says that WOW Air, which we know went through bankruptcy here just a couple of months ago, that they have been fined by the Iceland Environmental Agency. And it's pretty stunning. They've been fined 3.79 billion Icelandic krona, which, of course, as we all know, is about $30 million.
But that's a lot for a bankrupt company.
Well, it sure is, especially for a discount carrier, which you know, wasn't making any money. And you know, I would kind of speculate that the odds of them collecting on that are pretty slim at this point. But it still shows that this whole arena of you know, taxes and limit on carbon emissions is really starting to become serious and being felt in different parts of the industry.
I think pretty much all of these supersonic transport designs are using existing engines, or they're modifying existing engines. And so they don't represent a clean sheet of paper. You know, how would you design an engine to be as green as possible, but also to power a supersonic plane? Right? These are existing engines, and that's a problem, or that contributes to the fuel burn per passenger. Developing whole new engines for these supersonic planes would, I think, just kill the business case for the, you know, to develop these planes to begin with. So that's kind of problematic. But that that company that Boom Supersonic is working with is Prometheus Fuels. And their website is prometheusfuels.com. And you can take a look at that, but there isn't a whole lot on that website explaining just exactly what they're about. There's a video on the website, and they say in this video, and this is a quote, "We remove CO2 from the air and turn it into fuel. It creates," they say, "carbon neutral gasoline." So I'm not sure exactly what the technology is they're employing, but at least Boom is you know, kind of looking in that direction. Again, we're speaking with Jason Zilberbrand, President CTO of VREF, Aircraft Value Reference and Appraisal Services. Jason, your website is at VREF.com. That's pretty handy.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome, Jason. And to all our listeners out there who may be curious of what we're talking about when we say VREF, it's a play on words. When you're a pilot, there's all these V speeds, and V reference is a, I take it, a value reference, but it plays fun on the V speeds.
Yes, I could take credit for it, but it was before my time.
I think it's witty.
Yeah.
Very creative.
For those who don't know, in very simple terms, if you've ever sold a car or tried to go buy a used car, you grab the venerable blue book and look up what you think your car is worth, or what, more importantly, the insurance company thinks your car is worth. Well, VREF is that same function for aircraft. Is that a simple sentence, Jason?
Absolutely. That's what I say probably 25 times a day. We're the Kelly's Blue Book for aircraft.
Exactly. And it functions much the same way. You just can't go on to it. You have a subscription model, correct?
So we have a partnership with the AOPA, and we do have a database that's on the AOPA website for their members, which is free of charge. It's abridged, so you're not going to get every single option and every single modification, but it will get you in the ballpark. And then through us directly, you can subscribe either monthly or annually.
Jason, how do you determine the values?
Great question. So the appraisal services that we provide feed directly into our daily data research. We get provided closing numbers and purchase agreements on every single appraisal that we do. Really, the vast majority of the reporting comes from the financial institutions. So when the banks get a closing, they'll let us know. We have a relationship with, several hundred aircraft brokers. They're always reporting their numbers to us. And then, again, through the appraisals that we do.
one of the things that I want to take us down a little rabbit hole that's happened is that for those of us who've had to buy airplanes, it's not so much what I think it's worth or what the seller think it's worth. It's the darn banks and people who are going to finance me to make sure that what the loan, what they think the loan's going to be worth. And where I'm getting with that is, let me tell you my back history. You know, again, with my relationship with Pipistrel, our problem being was the financial institutions would come back and say, hey, you're not listed in VREF. And it's like, yeah, because our aircraft aren't showing up in trade a plane or controller because there's not that many used ones out there that are being exchanged. And when they are, they're calling the dealer directly and saying, hey, I want to sell my airplane. And the dealer's acting as a broker instantly within his buying cut within his customer database. So these aren't being publicly traded. What do you do to fix that, Jason?
So, yeah, you're right. A lot of banks, most credit unions on the piston side, they want to see the appraisal. It will occur at some point during the purchase process. So how do we deal with the, you know, the experimentals, the one-off? So we do the, we provide a desktop appraisal to the financial institution. That's the easy answer. But, you know, the complicated answer is for some manufacturers, we'll have to go and collect the data. We'll have to track their purchase orders and their closings over a period of time. We'll have to get comfortable enough that we know, you know, where their assets are trading, what the demand is on the new, and then we'll obviously release that data to the public. A perfect example is the Icon aircraft, which was struggling to get financing because there was no real legitimate source tracking what the valuations of that aircraft were. We went to great lengths to do that. And we assisted with several financial institutions in getting Icons funded. So, I mean, it's doable. It just takes work. It's a lot of collecting of data. We have, last count, 6,800 individual models that we track in VREF. That breaks down to like 440 makes. Our next closest competitor has 75. If you take all of our competitors combined, they still won't have what we're tracking. And we have a huge staff, but it's every time we add a new aircraft that goes into the research pile. So it's just more aircraft for us now to track. And so the cooperation of the manufacturers is absolutely required.
Now, in the case of Icon, you're talking about for the used market, or was that actually for funding of new aircraft?
This was actually the funding of a new one.
Really? So I guess the lenders just won't take list price as a value when they're lending it for a purchase.
No, I think that depends on, honestly, it depends on the customer. I mean, it really is a creditworthiness issue versus collateral issue. And that's not something that we ever get involved in. It's really, you know, it's none of our business. But at the end of the day, if the collateral is on the line because the credit might not be as strong as it should be, then the bank's going to want to be as comfortable as possible before they put that asset on their books.
How do you figure, and let's stick with the Icon, because they're even a better example than mine, because I don't think an Icon aircraft has exchanged hands in the used market. I think they're 100% are all original purchase owners.
Yeah, it's been all new deliveries.
How do you compute a, without getting dirty with the numbers, but how do you compute a resale value or depreciation against this type of aircraft?
So that is where it comes into looking at aircraft of, you know, similar make, similar model, similar equipment lists, and it gets complicated. And it really, you know, it's the, I guess it's that fine balancing act between, you know, playing mad scientist, weatherman, and forecasting versus having, you know, real empirical data to crunch. And you have to make extraordinary assumptions when you don't have the data. The good thing about aviation, general aviation, business aviation is, you know, history tends to repeat itself, good or bad. You know, the demand for the aircraft, the backlog for the aircraft, customer satisfaction. I think the lack of pre-owned transactions or lack of reported pre-owned transactions speaks volumes to how popular the aircraft is. That makes us more comfortable. We always get a little worried when we see a bunch of new airplanes get put on the market.
You get a little suspicious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you know, if you look at the exotic car market, you see that on a regular basis. And it's not that it's a true apples to apples comparison, but I'd say, you know, a car that sells for $500,000 and they make 100 of is a direct comparison to a piston airplane. And so if all of a sudden, you know, 2 out of every 5 that are getting delivered are immediately going up on the resale market, it's like, okay, we got a problem here.
Jason, I'd like you to look into your crystal ball, and I want to go down a little bit of a rabbit hole. I was looking at your actually pretty cool tutorial, and it showed that in the tutorial you're using a Bombardier 300, I believe.
Yes, and one of my favorite aircraft.
And you're showing us how to, you know, oh, if it has, you know, how to add value, you know, the equivalent of saying, does it have chrome wheels? Does it have an engine program? Blah, 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 blah. But one of the things that you put in there, and I'm going to come back to it, is it says, oh, does a Bombardier have ADS-B? And in the case of them, they're using the big boys, the Collins Pro 2100. Installing ADS-B in that airplane, by your example, is $75,000. Now, here's where I'm going with this question. In 5 months from now, ADS-B is mandatory. 2 weeks ago, FlightAware said 35% of the turbine markets they were, or turbine aircraft that were airborne, were not ADS-B compliant. I'm hearing at NBAA that a lot of these turbine airplanes come 1 January are going to get parked because the owners aren't willing to put out that kind of cash outlay, $75,000. With that as a scenario, are we about to see the turbine market suddenly have a pretty big step down to valuation, or are we just going to see all these airplanes move off out of Kona or out of the continental United States?
Great question. I mean, it's a loaded one. So when you look at the 15,000 or so business jets in the United States, almost half of those are older than 20 years. And, you know, when you look at the number or percentage of that fleet that hasn't complied with ADS-B, it's, you know, right around 40%. And probably on the 20 and older, it probably should be bumped up a little bit. I don't know that the 40% is really accurate. Maybe it's 50%. It could be as high as 60%. And I think the older you get, the higher that percentage is. And the truth is, those aircraft probably need to go away. I don't know that the people who own and operate those aircraft are truly flying them much anymore. I don't think that the general public will certainly miss some of these old aircraft. You know, the Smithsonian probably will take a couple of them and put them on display. But, I mean, they're functionally obsolete. And the technology gap over the last 10 years has been just astronomical. And the technology leap that we're about to see over the next 5 years is going to be something that, you know, we can't even comprehend because we haven't been using 5G and true broadband and really seen the capabilities of what any of these aircraft are going to be able to do. And I mean, we're not even talking about protecting the aircraft. I mean, you've got cybersecurity issues. You've got all sorts of things going on in today's world that these aircraft weren't built to defend themselves against. So not only are they expensive to operate and incredibly cost inefficient, but they're not worth a whole lot. And that's, you know, one of the things that we've been doing is redeveloping VREF. We are going to be launching it for NBAA, and it's completely brand new, built from the ground up. And one of the things that we're going to start doing is we're going to be providing scrap value.
Oh.
I think it's needed. I think it's something that we get a lot of requests for. And certainly as the fleet continues to age, you know, that's going to be something that people are going to be more interested in. But, yeah, I think you're starting to see, you know, a lot of early 80s, mid 80s aircraft get parted out simply because the cost of that upcoming event is way beyond what that aircraft is worth. And the truth is the parts aren't worth anything. I mean, you know, people dealing in parts of aircraft of that age, unless they already have somewhere to go with them, it's going to be a costly endeavor. You got to store it. It might take a decade to get rid of some of that stuff. So I don't know. I think fast forward 6 months from now, I think there's going to be a lot of aircraft that are going to be removed. Hopefully that results in some people taking that opportunity to replace them. I'm sure that's what everybody, you know, from the manufacturer standpoint is looking at.
Well, I'm sure all our listeners have disposable cash and are thinking about buying a new Learjet.
Yeah, exactly.
But are you thinking that we'll see the, if you will, the aggregate price level of turbine aircraft that are ADS-B flatline for a little bit or plateau because the options are suddenly, you know, buy brand new or buy me because half the market just went into the parking lot and is no good anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be a real interesting situation real quick. I mean, and we're not heading into what a lot of people are saying is going to be a strong year, you know, just with the election and all the nonsense we're going to be dealing with that. And, you know, if there's going to be a blip and it's 2020 and that's the little hiccup, you know, that everybody's been talking about, and now all of a sudden there's no aircraft. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're already in a seller's market. There's so many aircraft that are trading today that availability is under 5%, under 7%. And as you get into the trainer market on the piston side, it gets even worse. As you guys are well aware, if you're trying to find a 172, I mean, my response to people is good luck. We get called on all the time because people are just, they're going, I don't believe this. How could it have gone up 40% in a year? And that just goes to show you what the demand is. So I don't know. I mean, I think the business jet market is so different. It really, it's kind of a, you know, little monster unto itself. And while they're big ticket items, there's not a lot of as much activity. So is this like maybe the last thing that needed to happen to really correct this market? I mean, it's possible this is really going to, you know, could really fix things because you're going to be taking away a lot of aircraft that have been skewing the data for so long. Right. So, I mean, a lot of these aircraft have been sitting out there for thousands of days. I got news for you. If it goes past 200, there's something wrong. And it's not typically the aircraft. It's typically the seller. They want too much money for it. But, I mean, if you're going on 1,000 days, it shouldn't even be reported anymore. Hmm. And some of these aircraft, there's no way they could ever meet ADS-B requirement. The cost would just be astronomical. And, you know, the truth is, guys, the closer we get to the fall, the harder it's going to be to find a shop. And if you do, they're going to gouge you. I'm sure that's, you know, what they're waiting for. So,
well, yeah, that's the thing I was looking at is that unlike the airplanes that Max T and I fly, where, you know, it's an avionics shop and we can somewhat shop around for it, you know, finding someone who's certified to work on a Rockwell Collins, what is it, Premier 21 line of integrated avionics, and for $75,000, there's not a lot of shops out there that can do that.
No, there are not. And take a look at the parts list because every one of these jets basically has the same, you know, four part numbers as well. So they're all looking for the same components. And that's just going to drive the price up again. You know, price was dropping, I think, for the most part, because a lot of the suppliers were going, okay, you know, 60% of the fleet complied. And there's always procrastinators, right? I mean, we all had the roommate in college had decided to study for the final exam literally the hour before the exam. And this, I think, is no different. People are, they're funny. They do crazy things. I talk to people every day that, hey, you know, it's the first question I ask when I'm getting ready to do an appraisal. What's the deal with the 2020 compliance? I'd say 7 out of 10 times. Oh, yeah, we know we got to do it. That's the response, you know?
Jason, I wanted to ask you about your strategy for VREF offices, because you have a number of offices in the U.S., but also in Austria and Switzerland. Where else? Australia, I think in China as well.
Yeah, we just opened China.
What's the strategy for the different offices?
So we really wanted to grow or round out, you know, our appraisal division. And it's kind of self-serving. The more appraisals we do, the more data we get direct from the source and the better VREF's database is. So it really does feed into, you know, our daily research. But it's also been because of where the business is. And it's kind of one of those strange things. If you build it, they will come. And there was a lot of appraisers that were either sole proprietors or did aircraft appraisals, you know, secondary to, you know, some other job, and they didn't have the ability to manage their back office, or they didn't want to manage their back office. And there's a lot that goes into that. I mean, just the insurance alone for getting people, you know, airport liability and errors and omissions, it's expensive. And those costs go up every year. And so it was really just to facilitate our customer base. We have thousands of subscribers. Aviation is, while it's international, it's a really small community. And we try to hit the big, you know, hotspots location-wise. And we're actually, we've got a couple more offices that we're in the process of opening. And I don't know, at some point we'll have to call it a day. But, it, you know, right now it looks like we are getting a lot of attention, which is great. And we've just been really focused just on, you know, not only building the business, but completely rebuilding the platform.
And are you doing the development work in-house or?
So some of it is, it's a very complex undertaking. So we had to bring in an entire group of guys to rebuild VREF. The last time it was done is when it was originally built, which was, 15, 16 years ago. So right when the internet was was starting to gain in popularity, that's when the online version came out. And we're doing so many cool things. We've got, you know, we're finally opening up the archives, so you'll be able to buy VREF books all the way back to 94, which is something that we've never been able to do before, but we're switching to a virtual publishing house that'll be able to drop ship on demand, which is going to reduce the cost to our subscribers and reduce the amount of time it takes to get them the product. And the platform, gosh, there's so many things that we're doing with the platform. The first big thing, I'll let the cat out of the bag. You guys will be the first ones to know. So right now we have one tier of subscription, which is basically VREF. What you see is what you get. And what we're going to be doing is switching over to a tiered service. So tier one is going to stay exactly as it is today with all those same features. But tier two, you're going to get some really neat stuff. And retail and wholesale have been a kind of a pet peeve or bugaboo of mine and Ken's and some of the other appraisers for many, many years, because it's, while they're consumer phrases, they don't really mean anything in the appraisal world. They're not defined terms. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be still tracking retail and wholesale because that's what everybody knows. And in tier two, alongside of retail, it's going to be fair market value. And next to wholesale, it'll be inventory. And then we'll be offering orderly liquidation for tier three and then future residual values as well. And that's really going to take us, you know, the next phase is when all the data visualization and all the analytics will be phased in. So that's 2020. So MBAA will be the rollout of the brand new platform. And then 2020 early, hopefully February, we'll be rolling out the visualization package, which will be dashboarded out. And then from there, it's adding in the new category. So you guys were talking in the news about electric aircraft, and you know, we're certainly keeping an eye on all this stuff, UAVs especially. We're really watching drones. We're going to be bringing in a couple of drone appraisers. We actually have one right now that's going through a bunch of training, and he'll be the first one that's going to be doing full-time drone appraisal work in this country, which is pretty cool. We're also doing cybersecurity. So we brought a gentleman in from the Department of Homeland Security, and his name is Eric, and he works for us out of our Boise, Idaho office. And Eric is, not only is he a fascinating guy, but just one of the smartest men you'll ever meet. His specialty is airport security, infrastructure security, cybersecurity. So what we are doing is creating the first ever assessment plan to be able to walk in and show a flight department what their exposure is, not only from their aircraft, but from their building, from the time the principal leaves his home through the car, all the way to the time they get into the aircraft and go to their destination. And that's something we've been working on for months. And so we'll be rolling that out at the end of the summer. And that kind of, you know, should help bring a little bit more sense to why we have all these people. And, you know, so we do all the litigation consulting, which is really, you know, expert witness work. And unfortunately, in this country, people like to litigate. And even more so when there's a business jet involved. I don't know what it is about business jets and lawsuits, but they go hand in hand, kind of like divorces. It's the first thing that we get called on is to do the appraisal on the aircraft. So I don't see the litigation consulting slowing down as we go forward. And I guess, you know, crystal ball coming back, You know, if I was a betting man, I'd say you're going to see a slowdown next year. It's a matter of how much, you know, people are willing to brush it off. You know, I think so far everyone's been willing to brush it off.
Jason, I have a question about your litigation. Since the big 500 corporations have dumped their aviation departments and are now leasing or doing fractional ownership, how do you do valuation of a fractional ownership, especially when it's not directly tied to an N number or to a serial number?
Well, it is. So it's always tied to an aircraft. So contractually, every fractional owner owns an airplane. It's kind of like, I mean, it's real. It's a tangible asset, but the chances of them ever seeing it, I guess, are very slim. Fractional ownership is funny. So when it comes to appraisal work, it's no different than any other aircraft. We're given the aircraft serial number. We're given its, you know, specific specification list and its optional equipment and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And typically with NetJets, you know, they'll require there's three appraisals that they'll request. And that's typically if there's some sort of dispute at the end of the contract. I mean, they have a very high retention rating, so most of their customers are renewing. But if somebody does want to exit, then the exit strategy per the NetJets contract is, you know, the requirement of going down that appraisal path. So no, we don't appraise the, you know, the 16th share. We appraise the whole thing, and then it's up to them to do the math and figure out how they're gonna, you know,
do it. Okay, because that's what I was going for is company, you know, the Acme company is either getting bought or is decided to declare bankruptcy because they're being sued by a coyote, and suddenly one of their assets turns out they own, you know, 5/8 of some aircraft, and they say it's worth X, and you get called in to say, no, it's really worth Y. Is that what you kind of?
So, I mean, there's those disputes. I think there's those disputes every day. I mean, we, you know, most of that stuff settles out. And yes, we do, you know, have to. I did one a few weeks ago for a couple guys who were having a dispute with a really nice piston aircraft. They were partners. Everything was going great. They were setting aside money. They were doing the maintenance. And then one day, one of them just decided he had enough. And when he decided that he had enough, that's when, you know, the other guy didn't want to let him out. And there was a lot of beating up back and forth. So they agreed to hire me to mediate it. And it was great. I did an unbiased, you know, appraisal. I said, you know, I handed it to him. I said, guys, you know, split it. You know, take the high, take the low, split it, and call it a day. It's not worth it. And that's what they did. And I like when that stuff happens because at the end of the day, this country is way too litigious. There's way too many lawsuits going on. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's just, look, business aviation is not, we could spend hours talking about the war stories of business aviation. It's exciting stuff. You know, that's, everybody is fascinated, thinks it's the sexiest business in the world. And there is a lot to it. But at the end of the day, you're dealing with very wealthy people, very relentless, very ruthless. There's a lot of backstabbing. There's a lot of breach of contract because there's a lot of dollars at stake. And there's a lot of people that the 11th hour, they're going, you owe me money. And, you know, unfortunately, the escrow companies wind up playing, you know, police officer a lot. But it's I'd say that, you know, that type of stuff has been going on for decades, and I don't see it ever slowing down. And it's funny, when the economy gets tight, that's when people do just the craziest things, you know, but it is what it is, right? It's what makes it so exciting. But yeah, if you ever want to be a fly in the wall in aviation, you want to do it with a $40 million pre-owned business jet with two international parties, a buyer and a seller, and, you know, some pre-buy facility in the middle of Europe, and then watch everybody go ballistic right when the closing's about to happen. You know, it's either going to be extortion or, you know, it's coming. I promise you it's coming.
Let me bring you back to one of the functions you offer, and you literally refer to it as Carfax for aircraft. Talk to us about tracking damage history and how you get damage. Where are you getting your numbers or your history?
So we get our information from the FAA. We do have an office in Vienna, and it's run by a lawyer there, Dr. Andreas Grasel. And he does have access to the Austrian registry, so we can do it in Austria and in the United States. But there's no magic to running the background checks. I think the beauty of the VREF, you know, the verified report, really what it was created for was to assist people that don't necessarily have the knowledge base to do it on their own. And with thousands of subscribers and so many requests every day to help people do their own values, it was like, you know, there's a product that needs to be created here to fill this need. Because, you know, a desktop appraisal on a piston aircraft is, you know, $1,000. A lot of people don't want to spend that kind of money. And sure, you know, we discount it for the AOPA. And if you call me on a Thursday afternoon, I'll probably do it for a lot less. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's not people don't wake up in the morning and go, I got to call my appraiser. I got to get an appraisal. And so the Vera Verified report is, you know, it's a, you know, 5-page document, has a beautiful certificate of value. You know, either myself or one of the other senior appraisers goes through the equipment list and specifically builds that valuation. So it's as close to an appraisal as possible. It's not USPAP compliant. We're not, you know, applying any of our appraisal methodology. We're not going into the market and looking at what the comparisons are. But I got to tell you, VREF data is pretty accurate. And I use it 1,000 times a day. And if I see a mistake or if I see something that's wrong, I correct it or I send it to one of the engineers to correct it. But I mean, we're using it so many times a day that we've worked, you know, the bugs out of the data. And so, you know, you can get a pretty accurate range, which is what a lot of the AOPA members rely on, you know, and this isn't about billing, you know, dollars to clients. It's about helping them. And so, you know, the database really has everything for you to do it on your own. It just comes down to whether or not you have the expertise, or you might be your first time, or I don't know, you want to be able to hand that certificate to somebody else and say, look, somebody who's unbiased did it. And so you should take it, you know, with more than a grain of salt. That's the trick, really.
Yeah, let me give you, let me back that up and say yes, because for a future story, I am in walking down the road to purchase an aircraft, and the loaners wouldn't even talk to me there until I had to go have a tabletop done. And, you know, yeah, you worked with me, and they were like, yeah, if VREF says it's worth that, we're all good. And it was like, oh, okay. And it was really just very easy to do with DeFord.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we try and do. It shouldn't be complicated. It shouldn't be this, you know, mysterious crystal ball. Ooh, let me see what day of the week it is. I mean, we're very transparent. We want everybody to know where the stuff's coming from. The banks want to know. You know, the worst situation you have is when the bank all of a sudden is dealing with a situation, and let's just pick one, recourse. They've got a default, and now all of a sudden they've got an asset that they know that they're going to have to repossess. And they go into that file, and there's nothing there. Or worse yet, there's something there, and they don't really know what it is because it doesn't meet any legal requirements. There's no compliance. You know, every one of us goes through training, and USPAP compliance is not fun. But it basically means that, you know, when we send you a report that it meets the standards, you know, and practices, I can't tell you how many reports we get sent from financial institutions to review because they think that they have a problem with it. Our typical appraisal, as you know, is 50 pages. It's in depth for a reason. I mean, we're getting paid to provide an unbiased opinion to not only the financial institution, but you know, if you're the one who ordered it, and we take it seriously. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that phone it in and don't take it seriously. And I think every time that there's a, you know, hiccup in the economy, that's when you kind of know where those portfolios, their exposure lie, you know, who did the work.
All right. Well, we need to wind up our conversation here. But as you were talking, I logged into the AOPA site and I found VREF. I found it on my own. So I went to pilot resources and then aircraft and ownership. And then what did I click? Buying an aircraft, probably.
Buying an aircraft. And then there it is. And, you know, we'll be at EAA. There's going to be, I think, 15 of us at EAA. And I'll have a couple of my engineers and a lot of my international staff's coming. So for any of your listeners are going to be there and they want to grab one of us, we'll all be wearing shirts and hats, and we're happy to say hi and maybe even give you a free valuation if you twist my arm.
And they'll be present at the Potapalooza on Wednesday night at our pizza feed.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
For our listeners, real quick, he made a reference to USPAPA, which stands for the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. And that's a standards organization that these guys have to meet and that set down what an appraisal should be and all the minutia of how to do it.
Exactly.
And I want to say one other thing is, my question being is, since you were so gracious to announce on our show the breaking news of VREF's tiered system, I'm sure that that's coming out in 2020. Well, that'll just line up. You'll have a whole page devoted to Boeing 737 MAXs that, you know, appraisal of, you know, how long they've been sitting in a parking lot.
So we've been tracking that market now for like a year, and it's been wild, and it's absolutely having an impact. And I don't know. I think it's just one of those stories where everybody's so fascinated by it. How does something like this happen? But yeah, we're going to keep tabs of this one. And if there's anything that's crazy that we find out before anybody else, I'll let you guys know.
Oh, perfect. Great. Well, Jason, thanks so much. The website, of course, is vref.com. And you're also on social media.
Everywhere. We're too many places. We're LinkedIn, we're Facebooking, we're Instagramming. But honestly, LinkedIn has been great. We do COPA. We do a lot of the Cirrus Pilots Association. We do the Robinson group. There's too many organizations, but yeah, we support everybody.
Terrific. Jason, thanks again.
Thank you. I appreciate it, guys.
All right, now that we have Launchpad with us, it's kind of convenient because, Launchpad, you recorded a couple of other interviews from the Paris Air Show. And let's start with the Boeing TX.
Yes, as you remember, one of our listeners took a spy shot of an aircraft and said, "Hey, what is this?" Well, it was at Le Bourget, and it was the Boeing TX. And so I ran down to Boeing, and I got to speak to the chief test pilot. Let's let that run.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And we're in the Boeing pavilion right now, and I've managed to corner.
My name is Matt Fat Geesey, and I'm the Boeing F-15 chief pilot and a TX experimental test pilot for the Boeing company.
We hate you already for your job. All right, tell us about the TX that we're sitting next to.
So this is the all-new, specifically built design TX aircraft that was made for the United States Air Force. We won the contract back in September of 2018 to provide this advanced pilot training system of systems to the United States Air Force, who is our current and only customer on this platform.
And what we're looking at here is it's going to be the replacement for the T-38.
That's correct. The Air Force has realized that the aging T-38 is kind of outlived its life, if you will. And, with a lot of the advanced fighters that we have nowadays, it may not also be the best choice as a transition platform to go to these advanced fighters. So the decision was made to replace the aging T-38 fleet and get ahead of the game in doing so. And so Boeing took those Air Force requirements and designed and built this aircraft specifically for the U.S. Air Force, starting with a cockpit and building and designing everything around that cockpit.
Well, let's talk about the cockpit. It's glass, single display, multi-display?
So there are two cockpits, a front cockpit for the student and a rear cockpit for the instructor. Both cockpits have a large area glass display in them that's all color. It's programmable for a multitude of different programs. And it's also reconfigurable using both touch on the glass as well as hands-on throttle and stick or HOTAS. Additionally, the cockpit was specifically designed for excellent visibility from the rear cockpit. And what that means is stadium seating with excellent visibility looking forward both at the student displays as well as outside the cockpit. So from a safety standpoint, the instructor in the back seat can land the jet all the way down to the flare with good visibility looking outside, unlike most common fighters nowadays that have two seats. Additionally, the instructor in the rear cockpit can repeat the display of the student in the front seat. So the instructor has situational awareness on what the student's thinking, what you know, he or she is doing with the displays, and can make a real-time either correction or assessment of what the student's doing, saves time in the debrief, allows for a little bit more efficient training.
When we say a big glass, what are we talking about roughly?
So it's roughly 9 by 20 or 10 by 19 in that range. So it's a pretty large area display. Again, all glass. There's an eyebrow across the top that has a lot of the navigational type information. And then a majority of the lower part of the display are all of the tactical displays, system health displays, situational awareness that the pilot has on things like the flight control system, the engine, the electrical system are presented directly to the pilot.
So, and then there's different modes. So when you're in the, we'll say the administrative flyby, suddenly the, what we would consider the PFD is suddenly big and large, as opposed to if you're in a combat mode, it's over in the corner.
That's correct. And it's configurable per jet and per cockpit as well. So if a pilot or a student has personal preference, they can set that display up how they choose. But there are, for lack of a better term, master modes that you can use, one of which could be navigation, so your displays are set up for point-to-point, one of which is an air-to-air mode, so you can practice embedded training using a simulated radar display, a simulated electronic warfare display, or do some sort of air-to-ground delivery simulating the dropping of ordnance from the jet.
Okay, can you solo it from both cockpits or just one of them, the rear, the front? What's the?
So certainly the mission that the Air Force has asked for is a two-person aircraft, so it's a kind of a crew concept, student in the front, instructor in the rear cockpit. However, the aircraft can be completely manned, flown from the front cockpit only, and we expect that will be used on a case-by-case basis.
You own aircraft, you Boeing, I guess now turned over to the Air Force. Aircrafts 1 and 2. When's 3 and 4 coming?
So the plan is for aircrafts 3 through 5 to kind of help with the test program. I don't have the specific dates on when those will be off the line. What I can say is that after the test program is complete and we've started our production aircraft and prepared those for delivery, we will meet the Air Force delivery ferry dates in the 2023 timeframe with a IOC, initial operational capability, in the year 2024.
Now, is this a planes 1 and 2, were they low-weight production compatible or?
So we call TX-1 and TX-2 PRJs. That stands for Production Representative Jet. It was really important for us to demonstrate to the Air Force that these were not prototypes. These aircraft were built the way we're going to build the production airplanes, and we wanted to demonstrate to the USAF customer that we have the ability to show that early on, even before we started flight tests, that we can design and build these just like we're going to do the production jets. That would drive down risk on the program as a clean sheet design. In fact, the only clean sheet design competitor in this race.
All right. And it's going to have, it has a capability of being built for probe refueling or boom refueling, I should say.
Yeah, so one of the things that we did was we built and kind of generically speaking plumbed for an air refueling receptacle on the aft part on the top of the jet. I'm not sure what the U.S. Air Force is going to decide for that as a requirement or not, but the jet is prepped for that capability should the Air Force decide that's what they'd like to use.
This has been really good because it's exciting to see a brand new airplane. And how many hours do you have in it?
Yeah, this it is exciting. It was a big win for the Boeing company. This was a long time coming for us. I will say that, you know, from basically a bar napkin design to first flight was about 36 months. And so that, I think, speaks volumes to, you know, a fighter-type aircraft in today's development day and age, how we introduced all of these advanced manufacturing technologies to design and build this in really short order, and we did it safely and efficiently and ultimately won the contract because of that. I've had the opportunity to fly about 20 sorties or so of the 70-plus flights that have been done on the TX-1 and TX-2, and I'm looking forward to a long EMD phase of several months getting these aircraft ready for kind of the higher-risk testing down the road.
Well, there you have it, a spot report on the brand new airplane, the Boeing TX. This has been your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Great conversation, Launchpad.
Thanks. The Boeing people could not have been politer to us.
Oh, sure they could have. They could have offered you a demo ride. How did that part go?
Yeah, you're right. I need to raise the bar up some.
Yeah, we'll have a link in the show notes to Boeing's TX page. There's some nice images there. Now, Launchpad, you have another interview, one final interview for us.
I noticed, stepping back, that I tend to be, in aviation world, U.S. and somewhat European-centric. And we didn't invent airplanes solely here, or I shouldn't say we're not the only people who are flying them. So at the Paris Air Show, the Japanese Self-Defense Force was there. And I had a chance to talk to them. They brought two aircraft. And I went and asked to do a spot interview. And much to my surprise, I got to speak to Major General Gatto, who has a PhD in aeronautical design and is the program manager for aerial systems for Acquisition Technology Logistics Agency, which I think is the equivalent of their DARPA, about their brand new C-2, which is their new cargo airplane. Let's go ahead and roll the tape on that.
Hello, airplane geeks. Your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And we found a fairly unique airplane that surprised us here in the Paris Air Show. We're here underneath a Japanese C-2. Yes, a Japanese. And in fact, what I've got with me as a guest is...
I'm Major General Gatto from ATLA, Acquisition Technology and Logistics Agencies of Japanese Ministry of Defense.
Good. And we also have an interpreter with us.
My name is Takuma Yamaguchi, similarly from Acquisition Technology and Logistics Agency of Japan Ministry of Defense.
All right, airplane geeks, and let me explain what we're standing under the wing of. We're standing under the wing of what you would think of it as a small C-17 or C-141, but it's a fairly substantial airplane. Tell us about where this airplane fits market-wise.
In terms of the size, it's right in the middle between the C-17 and the C-130 aircraft.
Okay, because it is bigger than the C-130, and now that would make it compete directly with
A-400,
which is parked just along the way we're looking over at it, you know, with evil eyes. Some things about this aircraft that I found very unique. That talk to us about aerial refueling.
空中給油機能はフライングブームからの単価から我々は給油ができます.
So what we can do is the aircraft is capable of aerial refueling as a recipient using a flying boom or probe.
Roger, because the Japanese Self-Defense Force bought the Boeing
KC-767.
Because we have the KC-767 aerial refueling tanker.
Right, so you're not your a regular probe rather than hose and drogue, which has really put you in a unique place. Now, this aircraft is capable of flights up into the flight levels, correct?
That's correct.
3,000 feet or more.
It's capable of flying above the level of 30,000 feet.
But yet it still operates down low enough to act as a troop ship. We're going to pause for a second because you can tell we are at an air show and we're right now having a Raphael buzz over us.
So yes, it's capable of doing a low-level tactical flights simultaneously.
How many soldiers does it hold when it's configured for personnel?
So we can hold 110 personnel using side fixable seats.
Okay, and the aircraft we have here actually has the jump doors installed. So we'll do... Another pause for air show ambience. Yeah. But like the aircraft as it's displayed here, has the deflection doors on it to allow troops to parachute out.
ためのリフレクターっていうのを ありますよね。
じゃあ、あります。こちらです。
That's correct. We have the deflector shields, so when the paratroopers get out from the aircraft, the wind don't directly hit them.
Okay. Is the aircraft capable of soft field operations off of a non-prepared strip?
もともと要求は我々航空自衛隊はしていません。
So in the requirement of the Koku Jiaitai, which is the Japanese Air Defense Force, the capability to land on soft ground was not part of the requirement for the C2 aircraft.
コンセプトは我々は日本で応用し、運用するためには近くでは C-130 とヘリコプターで実施します。
So the concept is for soft landing operations, we use helicopters and C-130s.
Okay. Love the ambience. How many currently does this Japanese Self-Defense Force own?
8.
What do you think your total procurement will be?
約30機を調達する予定でいます。
So we hope to procure around 30 in the long run, in total.
All right. Are you going to do foreign military sales if it becomes if there's an inquiry?
なんで、もし引き合いがあれば、こちらの機体を移転するという可能性はありますでしょうか？
それはカスタマー次第だと思ってます。
So that depends on the customer.
I've been to every Paris Air Show since 91. And to my knowledge, this is the first time I've seen the Japanese Self-Defense Force here.
Yes. 2年前に P-1 はこちらに展示してます。
Yes. We actually sent P-1 2 years ago.
しかし今回は P-1 とこの C-2 を同時に展示してます。
However, this year around, we've decided to send...We decided to send 2 aircraft, C-2 and the P-1.
And listeners, we're not going to talk too much about the P-1. The P-1 is actually a naval surface aircraft designed to a similar mission as the P-8 Poseidon, naval patrol. But we're more interested right now in this great beast. We'll put the stats on our webpage for it. Sir, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak to us. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, out here among the thundering noise. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Yes, thank you.
I like the air show noise.
The reason we weren't actually in the aircraft and we had to kind of cut ourselves short is they were about to have a ceremony to receive some dignitary from the French government. So we were outside under the wing, and Major Gatto had to kind of pretty much cut us short because he had to go into the aircraft to receive this dignitary. But it was pretty cool. I was surprised to see it. And like I said, it's bigger. It's about the size of a Airbus A400. And I know that New Zealand's looking at buying them. They're toying with the idea. We'll put the stats up on our webpage. It's pretty cool.
And I note that it's powered by 2 GE CF6 engines, a reliable workhorse kind of an engine that would be appropriate for this kind of application. Great, great interview, both of them. Well, all three of them, including the one we had last week. Launchpad, thanks for doing that. Really appreciate it.
There was so much to do at the Paris Air Show. It was all I could do to just get three because I was running around, interview this guy, interview that guy. Oh, wait, there's a press conference we need to go to.
Yep.
And there's so much I missed.
That's right. There's always next year. All right, a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Let me give you an update on David because I know many of you are wondering and asking and David is actually in the hospital right now. He's been in there for a bit of a while, getting his blood sugar level back where it needs to be, and I think they've done that. And he's also been treated for some at least one infection. So David is he's doing okay. He's making progress. We probably won't see him here for a little longer, but hopefully David will get well quickly. I think he's starting to appear a little bit more on social media than he was earlier on. So please feel free to respond to him or send him a note, or you don't know how to contact him or find his Twitter or whatever, just let us know and we'll pass that along.
We miss you, Dave.
Listen to what came in when I wasn't watching.
Hi. This is David in Philly. Okay, Doylestown Hospital. I want to thank everyone for the well wishes. I will be back on Airplane Geeks probably in the next couple of weeks. My recovery is slow, but I'm looking forward to being back on the show. I miss all of you. Hopefully, everyone's doing well. I'm not history, just so you know. I'm the historian. So this is David at Doylestown. Thanks for all your well wishes, and we'll talk to you soon.
So let's see, Max West, have you been cheating on us?
I never thought of it quite that way, but yes, absolutely. I was interviewed last week for an episode of Opposing Basis, which was released on Monday of this week, episode number 80. And if you're unfamiliar with that show, there are two air traffic controllers who go by the code names RH and AG, which are their initials. Not sure why they go incognito, but I know that air traffic controllers, if pilots ask, for identification, they often are given initials. So they use that as part of the show. And they wanted to talk about flying in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I talked for about 40 minutes about the ins and outs and complexity of this particular type of airspace. They've done other shows in the past. I remember about the Atlanta area, how to fly in and out of there. I know they've got a show coming up on flying in and out of Chicago. Typically, they answer listener questions about ATC kinds of things, but occasionally they do these discussions about air traffic in other parts of the country. And their home base is in North Carolina, as I recall. And then this past weekend, I was out at the Hollister Airport, which I don't get too often, but I'm happy to report that the former Ding-a-Ling restaurant, which had closed some time ago, Ding-a-Ling, has been replaced. Yeah, I know. Isn't that a riot? Pilots here in the San Francisco Bay Area used to always know, hey, you go down to Hollister and you go to the Ding-a-Ling. And that closed probably a couple of years ago, but there is a new restaurant in there called Sibrisa's Eatery. I had the Cobb salad, though I'm told the fish tacos are spectacular. What I hadn't known before was that it's in a concrete building, which was formerly a brig. So back in World War II at Hollister, wow, it was a training base for pilots. And so this little concrete building on the property apparently was the brig. In fact, someone commented to me that they thought that the bathrooms were individual cells. And when I was in there, I thought, yep, just about 6 feet, probably exactly what they were. So that was pretty funny. So I have added that to the eatattheairport.com website, so people will now know about that. And by the way, I just added another one for Napa County. I was talking with a new flight school owner today at the Napa County Airport, and they had a well-known restaurant that was frequented by people for many years. It closed probably a couple years ago, but it's reopened as The Runway by Patrick, though it's closed on weekends. So all kinds of good food here at the San Francisco Bay Area.
Great. And Launchpad, what's doing in your neck of the woods?
Well, I wanted to comment on a former used to be a brig, and I'm like, man, the Navy's efficient. They even train you on how to be in the brig. Yeah. Okay, for me, just getting ready for Oshkosh, and again, I want to extend to all our listeners, Wednesday, 1800 in the Pipistrel booth. Again, we will have Potapalooza for all of our listeners and new media folks. It's a big pizza feed. Come by, hear the voices in your head. Max T, you won't be there this year, but you were there last year with us. And
yep, that's right. Great fun.
It is the best show in aviation. It really is. I'm not just saying that. It is my most favorite event of the year. all the people that make this industry so fantastic, the people that are passionate about aviation, they're the ones that are there.
And we're going to do Potapalooza, and I'm gearing up for that. So we'll feed you, and that's the Wednesday before the night air show. So everybody gets fat on pizza, then walks down to the other end and sits there and watches the night air show.
Great. Hey, you know who else is going to Osh this year is Grant McCarron. He's coming from Australia.
Ah.
Yeah, so I hope you get to run into him.
If he doesn't show, I'll hunt him down.
Very good. Jason, anything going on with you aviation-wise? Are you still flying these days or are too busy running the company?
Yeah, I don't have very much free time, as you can imagine. So,
yeah,
I'm up at ODARC 100 every morning. I get up at 5 a.m. and I get my 10K in, and I am still delusional in thinking that I'm going to continue to race and do marathons and stuff, but it's never going to happen. But there's no free time. This is actually end of June, July, because it's quiet. It's like the between conference season. So the next one's EAA, and then there's another little break, and then it starts all over again. It's, you know, conference season and conventions, but nothing too exciting.
All right. A shout out. We heard from Kay. She wrote to us about David Hamilton, last living World War II Pathfinder pilot. Drops paratroopers out of C-47 on his 97th birthday. So on July 20th, Hamilton will be 97 years old, Lieutenant Colonel David Hamilton. He enlisted on December 8th, 1941. He trained as a C-47 pilot, then later as a Pathfinder pilot. Now, Pathfinder air crews were specially trained World War II air crews. They flew C-47s that had cutting-edge navigational equipment. And Dave just got back from England and France, where he flew across the English Channel in a veteran aircraft, a C-53, that was part of the D-Day squadron. We've talked about the D-Day squadron, that formation of American C-47s and C-53s. They flew across the channel on June 5th. And Dave was actually, get this, 97 years old, right? Was actually at the controls of the C-53 for part of that flight. That being 75 years after he made his original D-Day flight. And when he was in England, he was honored in North Witham by folks who live near where the RAF base was, from which he flew the D-Day mission. And he was a guest at the ceremonies at the American Cemetery at Omaha Beach on June 6th. Dave was pretty much treated like a rock star everywhere he went in England and France. I can understand that. Well, Dave and the 75th anniversary of D-Day are going to be honored again at this year's October Wings Out West Air Show on October 5th. And that's actually in Dave's hometown of Prescott, Arizona, where another World War II D-Day veteran, the C-53 D-Day doll, will be doing a drop of World War II type paratroopers to honor Dave and the 75th anniversary of D-Day. So he's going to be in the cockpit of the C-47 near Frederick, Oklahoma, dropping the airborne demonstration team's World War II style paratroopers on July 20th. Okay, so that's coming up pretty quick, July 20th, which happens, of course, to be Dave's 97th birthday. And the Frederick, Oklahoma airfield is home of the Frederick Army Airfield, which still has a wonderful World War II era wooden hangar in which sit a couple of C-47s, also various World War II vehicles. This is also the home of ADT's World War II style jump school, complete with all of the paraphernalia that goes along with that: parachute packing tables, training hangars, the mess hall, classrooms and barracks, things like that. And when you walk into this hangar, they say it's like stepping back in time 75 years. They even have period music playing over the loudspeakers. So come out to this event This will be a great story about the last living Pathfinder dropping paratroopers on his 97th birthday. Thanks to Kay for passing that along. We'll have some of those details in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/560. Let's see. We have another event coming up. Launchpad. You've given us a lot of really great Red Bull Air Race reports in the past. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this weekend, 13 and 14 July, is the last Red Bull Air Race. It's kind of coming to an end, and you can watch it on Red Bull TV. This weekend, you can tune in casually while you're doing other work and watch the air race and cheer along for friend of the podcast, Michael Goulian, local hometown boy from Texas, Kirby Chambliss, and friend of the podcast again, Patrick Davidson, who's racing in the Challenger class. But this is going to be the last Red Bull Air Race, unfortunately. So it should be a pretty good one. And you can say you saw it. It's always been entertaining.
And again, this is July 13th and 14th.
Correct.
All right. Well, that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. Jason, we want to thank you, President of VREF Aircraft Value Reference and Appraisal Services, VREF.com. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Max. It was great being with you guys, and hopefully I'll get to see you at Oshkosh.
All right. You can find us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/560. If you want to send us email, you can write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Also look for us on Twitter and Facebook and a few other places. And if you haven't joined our Slack team, consider doing that. It's our sort of little semi-private hangout area for fans, friends, listeners of the show. If you'd like to learn more about how you can get involved in that, to see, just take a look at airplanegeeks.com/team. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Max Trescott, you first.
Well, I just want to mention that this week's episode of Aviation News Talk number 113 is about understanding electrical systems, that is aircraft electrical systems, and how to deal with system malfunctions and emergencies with that. So I get to put my professor hat on and hark back to my days as an electrical engineer and talk about that a little bit. And of course, you can always find me at aviationnewstalk.com. Click on email at the top of the page, or actually it's click on contact if you want to send me an email. And you also can leave any listener questions there, which I'll try to answer on the show.
You know, I did listen to your latest episode, and this... It was clearly recorded by someone who'd been an electrical engineer, because you really got into it pretty deep. It was pretty great. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Well, that's what I try to do. I try to take a subject that people think they know, you know, something about, but hopefully there's always at least one nugget in there for even the folks that know a lot about a subject when they listen to it.
Nicely done. Good job.
Thanks.
Launchpad Merzari, how do we find you online?
I'm at Facebook at Launchpad Merzari. I'm on Twitter as Pilot Launchpad. I'm not very good at Twitter. And then I try and not be a slacker on our Slack team.
Yeah. All right, thanks. And yeah, you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Also look for me on LinkedIn at the UAVDigest.com with David Vanderhoof talking about unmanned aviation. Also at the PAXX podcast with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience. Our outro is by Bruno Missone. Find more of his compositions at brunomissone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Frequency change approved. And for David, thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments...